Cox versus Airland Transport, Mr. Henson.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Chris Henson, and I'm here on behalf of my client, Robert Takas. Your Honor, essentially, this case comes down to this. When my client was fired, the employer told him that it was partly our fault in the first place for hiring a disabled person. The employer, in the same conversation in which my client was terminated, my client was called crippled and handicapped. Notwithstanding that evidence and other evidence relating to my client's injury and subsequent disabilities, the district court granted summary judgment saying that no reasonable juror could conclude that Airland Transport, the employer in this case, could regard my client as being disabled. I included in the brief, and I included on the district court, the dictionary definitions of the terms used, particularly the word crippled. Definition of that is to deprive the use of a limb. He was called crippled. Now, putting this in some context, when he first hired on, he indicated on his application that he was disabled. He indicated on income certification paper that he was disabled. He had several conversations with his supervisor, including the person who fired him, talking about his injury. In fact, at one point he said, "You're entitled to a tax credit for hiring a disabled veteran." He acknowledged, he being Darren Merrill, that Robert Takas brought to this his attention. The basis, alleged basis for terminating my client was an alleged safety violation.
But is there any evidence that the employer thought that he was disabled within the meaning of the ADA, that this problem with his hand interfered with a substantial life activity?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that, and it does require an inference here, but the inference is by calling my client crippled and referring specifically to his arm and his hand, applying the objective definition of that word, deprive the use, it'd be my position that someone who's deprived the use of a hand would be substantially, or an arm.
Are you saying they exaggerated the severity of his disability?
I believe that in their mind it was worse than it actually was, yes. The accident that he was terminated for was, like you said, an alleged safety violation, where if you look in there, it says because my client used one hand. Well, if my client used one hand, I think it's an inference that the employer, Darren Merrill, thought that he only could use one hand.
Didn't they know precisely the nature of his injuries?
No, Your Honor, they denied knowledge.
But he was a truck driver, right?
Correct.
So they must have known that he could drive a truck even though he had this injured hand.
That is correct. He passed the IDOT test, which is...
So didn't they know what his disability was? What makes you think they exaggerated it?
They claimed that they didn't know of the disability. They denied this conversation ever took place.
Well, on his questionnaire, he said he didn't have anything that would make him unable to perform the function of his job, did he?
That is correct, Your Honor. I would point out, however, that the inquiry is at the time of the termination as opposed to when he was hired. And what they thought at the time he was terminated, after all these conversations, after this accident, the state of mind of the employer could have been much different when it fired him from he's crippled and he's handicapped. Clearly, they wouldn't have called him crippled and handicapped when they hired him, because then they can say, well, look, there's nothing on here. But this is not a failure to hire case, this is a termination case. And by that point, after these chains of events occurred, their knowledge changed based upon what had occurred. So my point is, I understand what you're saying, but my point is, it changed over time, particularly with that alleged safety violation. I go into some detail about direct evidence and indirect evidence and what should be applied. I believe that that's direct evidence. I mean, we have the objective definition of the word in the dictionary saying that deprive the use of a limb. I believe that that is direct evidence, particularly when he goes on to call him crippled and handicapped. The Hoffman case articulates much better than I could what the rationale behind the ADA is in terms of stereotypes and that type of thing. I would liken that exchange that the employer had with my client, for instance, to a Title VII claim, where if an African-American had been fired and the employer said, well, it was probably our fault for hiring an African-American. It's the same thing that's occurred here. Also applying the indirect evidence, which I don't think you need to get to, but if you do, there's a non-disabled employee who committed two safety violations and willfully disobeyed an order, this is all in the same time period, for 2 weeks before he was terminated. In the deposition, the representative from Airland said, if it's a probationary employee, which both my client and this non-disabled client were, if they were a probationary employee, they automatically got fired at the first sign of a safety violation, which is what happened to my client. The first sign of this happened, he was gone. He retracted that when confronted with the fact that a non-disabled employee, right about the same time, I believe this was in November and these events occurred in January, was afforded two safety violations and continued to willfully disobey the directive of the employer. The circuit has held that if the only difference between two people is something that's protected by law, here disabled as opposed to non-disabled, that is evidence, can be used as evidence under the indirect evidence test.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hanson. Ms. Lipson there?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tracy Lipsinger, and I represent Airland Transport. Your Honor, the threshold issue in this case is whether or not Robert Tarkas is a qualified individual with a disability, as those terms are defined by the Americans with Disabilities Act. No single piece of evidence, no line of deposition testimony is more revealing of Mr. Tarkas' inability to demonstrate his membership in this protected class than in responding to the question, who at Airland regarded you as disabled? Mr. Tarkas answered, they knew of my disability. I don't know if they thought I was disabled. The definition under the Americans with Disabilities Act for a regarded as claim, which is the only issue.
Well, Mr. Henson said that was when he was hired, but later they decided he was crippled and he really wasn't. That's his basic argument.
Except that there are no facts in the record, Your Honor, from which a reasonable juror could conclude that Airland learned anything between his date of hire, the first day he started in training, January 2nd.
He may not have learned anything, but decided that, well, it's worse than they had thought. Why would they call him crippled if he just has a relatively minor hand injury?
Whether they called him crippled,
well, what was the matter with his hand, anyway?
He broke his hand in the military in 1988.
And it didn't heal?
I'm not certain. He indicates that he has impairments to this day to things like baiting fish hooks and shooting guns. But the Department of Transportation...
But he's able to drive a truck?
Drive a truck. He can perform all of the essential functions of his job as a truck driver, which include shifting...
But the truck wasn't... adapted to his, he was shifting with his right hand.
That's correct, Your Honor. That was not an automatic vehicle.
He gets disability benefits, doesn't he?
20% disability compensation, Your Honor, that's correct. And under the Supreme Court's recent decision of Toyota Motor Manufacturing versus Williams, 20% could hardly be said to be an individual who was prevented from or significantly restricted in performing any tasks that's central to daily life. Now, Mr. Takis, after describing the limitations that he reports imposed by whatever continuing element of the injury to his hand, admits that he never told Darren Merrill or any person at Airland about these limitations. He concedes, essentially, that the only thing that Airland could have known, the only factual antecedent upon which it could base a belief, is that they knew he could drive a truck. Now, the cases previously decided by this court suggest that where a plaintiff relies upon words used at the time of termination, such as disabled, like in the Wright versus Department of Corrections case, that at some point in time, the plaintiff has to be able to identify the factually antecedent materials upon which some mistaken belief could have formed. And in fact, in the Wright case, this court held that use of the word disabled during a termination notification was insufficient as a matter of law to demonstrate the employer regarded the plaintiff's right as disabled. The reason being that Mr. Wright had passed a physical agility test narrowly tailored to the requirements of his job as a correctional officer. Likewise, in this case, Robert Takis passed the Department of Transportation physical, indicating that he had full range of motion in his upper extremities, and he further reported to the examining physician that he suffered no permanent defect from illness, injury, or disease. Those are the facts that Airlines had when it hired him, believing him to be capable of performing his duties. He performed his duties for a period of 2 weeks without complaining about difficulty with the transmission or an inability to hook and unhook the trailer. Then he shows up to Keystone at 4 o'clock in the morning, as required, on January 31st. And he gets hurt. And why does he get hurt? He gets hurt because he failed to follow the specific safety protocol that Airland instructed him on during his one-week training course. Load securement is particularly important to flatbed trailers. You've ever driven past or behind one on a highway, I'm sure you, like I have imagined, I wonder what happens if that strap pops and 2 tons of steel pipe rolls off. One of the ways that motor carriers ensure that those types of things don't happen, such as Airland, is to train specifically on how you get the strap from one side of the truck to the other and how it fits into the connecting mechanism. Both Darren Merrill and
this is a flatbed truck.
That's correct, Your Honor. Both Darren Merrill and Mike Minton testified that it is a violation of Airland's safety policy to hold the ratchet, which is the mechanism to which the strap feeds, with one hand and operate the winch bar with the other hand. In his deposition, Robert Takis conceded that he committed that specific violation of safety protocol. Tom Damon, the Vice President of Operations for Airland, made the decision to terminate Takis' employment based not only upon this violation of protocol, but also because when Robert Takis called in to report this incident, he blamed it on poor equipment. 2 days later, he fills out a written report and he blames faulty equipment. Darren Merrill and Mike Minton interview Takis. They take him out to the yard, ask him to show them what he was doing when the ratchet and winch bar mechanism
fell. Is this an alternative ground you're arguing that he's not protected by the act because he's not qualified? What is this?
I'm not arguing that he's not qualified, Your Honor. I argue, one, that he's not protected by the act, and two, even if he falls into the definition that Airland's determination of the appropriate remedy to his violation of the clear safety policy is a non-protectual decision. And Takis cannot point to Roger Boatman as a similarly situated individual, because Roger Boatman didn't attempt to conceal the nature of his violation. Not to mention the fact that Roger Boatman was terminated after one warning. He's an over-the-road truck driver. By the time we figured out it was failure to have a ladder on his rig, he climbed up on it in inclement weather. When he climbed down, he slipped and hurt himself. He came in, he said, "Where's your ladder?" He said, "Didn't have one." He got a written warning. When he came back from his next trip, we said, "Where's your ladder?" He said, "Oh, I forgot to get one." Darren Merrill takes a written warning up to Tom Damon and says, and this is in Mr. Merrill's deposition, "I think we ought to give this guy another warning." And Tom Damon says, "No. We're going to fire people who violate clear safety policies during their probationary period." Over its lifetime, Airline has learned that people who don't take care in the first 60 days of their employment are more likely to pose a risk of injury to themselves and to the general public down the road. For these reasons, the reasons cited in our brief, we ask that the court, in its review, affirm the entry of summary judgment in favor of Airland on all counts.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Whitson. Mr. Hanson, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
One of the questions here is about the subjective belief of Airland at the time. If you look at this accident that occurred, the evidence came that he was using one arm. This is Darren Merrill. Right after that, when he's terminated, he calls him partly our fault for hiring a disabled person, calls him crippled, calls him handicapped. A reasonable inference from that is based upon these conversations he's had before, based upon these documents that he's filled out indicating that he's disabled, based upon this accident that occurred that Merrill very well could have thought that the reason was because my client only had one hand, he terminated. So in terms of evidence to support that, there is. And my position is a jury can infer from that that Airland regarded my client as being disabled. And that doesn't even get to the issue of direct discrimination when the dictionary definition of the word indicates something that would be covered by the ADA.
Okay, thank you very much.